Our next speaker, while he's getting set up, I'll just say a few words. Ross Hammond, who is a fellow in economic studies at the Brookings Institute in the United States, and he's going to talk about agent-based computational modeling, which we'll see some similarities to system dynamics and also some important differences.
Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, David. And thanks to Laurette and everyone else involved in organizing this wonderful event. I think it's really quite interesting. I'm going to talk about another approach that comes from the systems modeling toolkit that's called agent-based computational modeling. I will introduce it briefly and tell you a little bit about how it works. Then I'll show you, because a picture is worth more than 1,000 words in this case, two actual agent-based models and how they work. And then I'll talk a little bit about potential applications to obesity, including some work that I'm doing with Laurette and other colleagues here at McGill. I'm going to try to cover a lot of ground in a short amount of time, so bear with me, and I'll take questions at the end. Agent-based modeling is a powerful and relatively new method made possible by increases in computing power that allows us to model complex social dynamics on computers. In an agent-based model, we build essentially an artificial society on a computer of individuals who we call agents, and we give these individuals some simple adaptive rules that govern their interaction with each other and with their environment. These agents can be at any or multiple levels of aggregation. So an agent can be a person, and they often are, but they can also be a firm or a government or a cell. We place these agents in a spatial context. We give them some simple starting conditions, and then we simulate from the bottom up, stochastically, and observe the social patterns that emerge from this collection of individuals. So it's a bottom-up generative modeling approach. There are some advantages to modeling in this fashion that I think are particularly relevant for the topics we're looking at today. This is a very rigorous technique since the macro patterns follow from the micro assumptions and both are comparable to data. But we found in our modeling work that there's a huge increase in accessibility to decision makers when you have these so-called rule-based models, because it's easy for a policymaker or any other decision maker to understand in a pretty deep way exactly how the model's working without recourse to a math background, because the individual rules that drive the model that are governing the behavior of these agents can usually be explained in English. These are also highly visual and spatially realistic models, as I'll show you in a second. They can be quite user-friendly and interactive, and this can facilitate interdisciplinary model development. And importantly, for some of the issues that were raised this morning, these models allow for less restrictive assumptions about individuals and system-level behavior than conventional mathematical modeling approaches often do. In conventional mathematical models, one or more of these assumptions are usually made to allow the math to be tractable. Some of these will seem familiar to you depending on your background. In economics, we often have representative agents, and there's a strong assumption about homogeneity of all the agents. In epidemiology, we often have an assumption about random mixing in compartments. We have assumptions about equilibrium, about an absence of feedback of the type we saw in the last talk, of learning or adaptation. We have very strong assumptions about individual decision-making and rationality, and there's often just a focus on a single level of analysis at a time. And with agent-based models, they're very flexible, which is both a strength and a weakness, by the way. But the strength part of it is that it allows us to replace homogeneity with heterogeneity. Because we're explicitly modeling each individual in the population, we can allow them to differ in any way that we like, in any way that's important for the model. So they can have different demography, different network locations, different decision-making, psychology, immunocompetence, anything, genetics, anything that matters. We can replace random mixing assumptions with real space, network structures, and so on. I'll show you an example of that in a minute. We can replace a focus on equilibrium with a focus on dynamics and explore things like tipping and uncover mechanisms that are at work. And we can include adaptation by individuals, evolution in biology models, and learning. And we can have much more realistic views of individual decision-making and include them in the models. And finally, and most importantly for some of what I want to talk about later, we can capture multiple levels of analysis at a time with a fair amount of ease and explore dynamics across these levels. So there are particular advantages of agent-based modeling for life course modeling, for modeling things like obesity that happen over long periods of time. We can follow individuals in an agent-based model across time and get detailed information at every step in time, explore the dynamics as they adapt over time. We can also capture multiple determinants of health. We can explore interaction between individual and biology and society and environment. And we can facilitate modeling across different disciplines that are involved in each of these levels of analysis. So I've applied this approach in a wide variety of areas that topically, this is a partial list here. Today I'm going to show you three particular examples that I think are most relevant. I'm going to begin by showing you a model of how an agent approach can provide a policy laboratory to uncover novel kinds of interventions and explore their effectiveness inside a model before implementing them in the real world. This is a model that was developed at Brookings as part of the Smallpox Working Group for Health and Human Services, chaired by D.A. Henderson, with a large interdisciplinary team with all sorts of intensive meetings to arrive at key assumptions about biomedical and behavioral inputs into the model. This is a model of smallpox. Smallpox has a quite complex natural history, all of which is included in an exquisite detail in the published model. But for the purposes of illustration, I will be showing you a simplified progression that works like this. An individual starts in this susceptible state. They don't have the disease yet. They're colored blue. Then they contract smallpox on day zero. For a 12-day period, they're colored green. They're infected, but they have no symptoms, and they're not contagious. And no one knows they have smallpox, including themselves. So this 12-day incubation period turns out to be critical. Then there's a short period where they're colored yellow. They have early symptoms. They're somewhat contagious. And then they turn red, become highly contagious, develop the classic smallpox rash. And then with probability 0.3, they die and turn black. And with probability 0.7, they recover and turn white. So this is the model of the disease. And we're going to drop this model into a simple two-town county. Again, in the published results, this is drawn from careful demography and spatial modeling. I'm going to show you again a simplification, but in fact, the simplification, both of the disease and the space, still reveals all the key core insights that the Fuller model reveals. And so this is an important thing to bear in mind when we talk about model complexity. This simplified version works as follows. There are two towns, a square town up here and circle town down on the bottom. Each town has 100 households, which are these squares that you see. And inside each household, there are four individuals, two parents and two kids. Again, not realistic, real demography in the published version. Each of the households are all home at night. This is nighttime. So they're all in their houses, tucking their kids into bed. During the day, the adults go to work and the kids go to school. There's no school busing, so all the square town kids go to square town school. And all the circle town kids go to circle town school. There is commuting, so some circle towners work in square town. Some are doctors or healthcare workers and work in the common county hospital. And there's also a common county morgue, which unfortunately will turn out to be needed in this model. And the basic progression of time is night, day, night, day, night, day, like this. And these particular social mixing locations were picked based on the units that loom largest in the epidemiological data that we had on smallpox. So they aren't just random. They're built for a particular purpose. And we're going to drop into this contact pattern the pathogen I described earlier, the smallpox. So here's a base case of this agent-based model in action. There's no policy interventions, no background immunity, and there's a single starting case who's Mr. Green down here. In a little bit, he's going to turn yellow and give it to his wife. She works up in Square Town, too. So we're going night, day, like this. And you can watch the spread of smallpox through this community. Now, an important facet of the agent-based model is that we're tracking each individual here. So we know precisely who gave it to whom and when and where. And we can exploit that knowledge to design better policies. So this goes ahead and spreads through the population here. I'll skip it ahead a little bit. And you can see two things that I want you to notice early on in the epidemic. The first is that the disease is already quite a bit more advanced up here in Squaretown, even though it started by Mr. Green down here in Circletown. So the purpose of this model was to look at vaccination strategies. And a very simple vaccination strategy is find the town where it broke out and vaccinate everybody there. But in this case, that strategy would fail because it's already long gone from Circletown by the time the epidemic really gets going. And that's because of this incubation period. So that's already a qualitative feature that's been revealed by the model. If I go ahead quite a bit in time, you'll see that the hospital gets overrun, that the morgue gets quite busy too, and that in the end, everybody in the population gets the disease and a third of them die. And that's how it was in pre-vaccine Europe with smallpox. So now we're going to look at interventions. This is the infection curve for that epidemic that I just showed you. So we calibrated this model to data from European outbreaks. I won't go into the details of that, but if you're interested, you can look in the paper. It's in an International Journal for Infectious Disease. And there were basically two policy options on the table at the time this modeling was done. The first is called trace vaccination. Trace vaccination says find a confirmed case of smallpox, track down everybody that person had contact with, and give them all a vaccine shot. And that works really great in rural India, actually. It was put to good use. But it completely fails if you happen to have been in O'Hare Airport or the D.C. Metro system or any number of other places in our mobile world. In 14 days, you could be all the way across the world and back. So we'd lose the so-called race to trace. The other option was mass vaccination. It was being seriously discussed this is in U.S. policy circles. But the smallpox vaccine isn't a hugely safe one. It does have some serious side effects. If you have the recessive gene for eczema, you can be scarred for life by the vaccine. If you are immune compromised in any way, it can kill you. So you really don't necessarily want to vaccinate 300 million people unless you really have to. So this group was tasked with coming up with a better vaccination strategy that would be effective and yet involve the smallest number of actual vaccinees. And we, again, have these all sorts of beautiful data coming out of these models that we can exploit due to our ability to follow specific individuals and design policies based on that knowledge. So we came up with a strategy of preemptively vaccinating hospital workers and their immediate and then reactively vaccinating the immediate household members of confirmed contacts. So the number of people being vaccinated is very small, but you get this black line instead of this red line. So it makes a huge difference if you do just that intervention. And that's an intervention that was not being considered or discussed before this modeling exercise was done that was suggested by this model. So the flavor I want you to get here is not necessarily the ins and outs of smallpox, but that these models can serve this role as sort of laboratories for policy design and experimentation with interventions. Now I'm going to move to a totally different topical area, but I'm going to show you a different kind of agent-based model that works somewhat differently. And actually, this model, I think, has an awful lot of relevance, has many of the features that we'd like in an obesity agent-based model, which is why I'm showing it to you. The actual topic area is anthropology here, but this is a multi-level model. It's going to have interaction between individuals, their environment, and their society. It's going to have relation to data at several of these different levels. There's going to be realistic physiology, realistic social structure, and a real GIS-built environment. There's going to be agents modeled across the entire life course all through all developmental stages, and it's going to grow a real observed history. This is a model published in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2002. It's a model of people called the Kayenta Anasazi who lived in a place called Longhouse Valley in Four Corners area of Arizona from about 1800 to about 1350. We had exquisite data on the actual environment that faced by these people who were monoagriculturists. And we also had really good demographic history of who lived where and when. This is from hydrology, topsoil analysis, tree ring dating, lots of fancy archaeology techniques. And the idea here was to use an agent-based model to test various rules of behavior for these individuals and to find ones that allowed us to grow the entire real observed history. About 80% of this valley has been excavated, and since we know who lived where when, we're going to try to replicate that pattern in, you know, retrodict it, if you like, in real spatiotemporal fashion. This is the place, Longhouse Valley in Arizona. This is a sample of the kind of climate data that we were working with. Here are some simple rules that give you a sense of the kind of rules that drive these models and how easily they can be explained. The Anasazi have rules that tell them to live close to their fields but not in them, and to live near potable water when they can, to move after several periods of unsuccessful harvest and to ask their friends where a good place to move might be. They have some simple demography, and they have basic nutritional needs, which are based on anthropological records. I won't go into too many details of that. So here's the model in action. You're seeing a frozen moment in time in the model. On the left is the simulation. On the right is the real observed history, digitized. And the blue shape here is the valley. And the blue color, which is going to ebb and flow over time, represents the amount of water available. It's underground water, not surface water. And these little white dots are the household settlements along the edges of the valley. And we're going to watch over time both the artificial Anasazi on the left and the real Anasazi on the right, and we're going to see how good a job the model can do at replicating this observed history. And again, this is a real GIS representation of the space. And I should say at this point that these are stochastic models. What you're seeing is a single path through this stochastic process, a single realization of the model. In our published results, we never just talk about a single realization like this. We talk about many, many runs with statistics across all of them so that we can get a really good sense of the behavior of this model. But I want you to take away from this is to see that the model actually can do quite a good job of replicating the spatial pattern of settlement in this society. And in the aggregate, this is how well it does. The modeled population is the blue line, and the actual population is the orange line. And what's interesting about this is both how closely the fit is, but also where there are important differences, like on the far right here, where the actual population disappeared entirely, and the modeled population continues to exist indefinitely at a low level. And these are very suggestive about what's missing from this model. This model is designed to focus just on environmental variables and demography, and there's no social structure, there's no politics, there's no interethnic war, nothing of that nature in this model. And there's reason to believe, especially with this evidence, that the next iteration of the model should include those things. So the idea of reconstructing an observed history with one of these models is an idea that we'd like to try to apply to obesity. And the prerequisite for such an effort is to have good longitudinal data to work with. Fortunately, we heard this morning about quite a lot of this data that's starting to be available, that is available. I'm almost done. Obesity is, as we've heard earlier today, a quite complex problem. It involves multiple levels of aggregation from genetics all the way up through markets and the built environment. There's lots of mechanisms at work, and there's links and feedback between these levels that are not well understood yet. And there's substantial spatial and temporal variation, so no single explanation seems able to account for everything we know about obesity. So this just calls out for a multi-level systems approach, and I think agent-based modeling can help facilitate that. My early work on this has focused on two particular factors, physiology and social norms, and their interaction. And we had a couple interesting results, but a full, more comprehensive agent-based modeling approach would include the full span of these levels. I have a recent paper that articulates a vision of what such a model might look like and some modeling strategies for accomplishing that. We have have just begun an exciting collaboration with a new NIH network that Terry here has really put together and made happen. And this is a network of teams that will be using systems methods to study childhood obesity. I'm fortunate enough to be part of that network with my collaborator, Laurette, here. And we'll be taking a modular approach to studying obesity with an agent-based model, to have a separate piece of the model for each of these key levels, and then to explore interactions across them. And the goal of this effort will be, over the next 5 years, to build a scientifically explanatory agent-based model that can explain and replicate outcomes we observe in the real world, but from a multi-year developmental, multi-level perspective, and to develop a policy tool that will allow us to explore relative effectiveness of existing policies and hopefully to develop some counterintuitive new kinds of interventions, as I showed in the smallpox case. Skip ahead. Thank you very much. I'll take questions.
Thank you, Ross. Really, really interesting. I think a very nice follow-on to this dynamic piece. I'll just open with one question. When I saw the Anastasi example, it became clear at the end, obviously, that there's something that just didn't explain the complete disappearance of the population, which makes me think that, how many models could you build to explain the data? How do you really know when you try and go far beyond the data, or even, how do you really know what's missing in some sense? Is this the one model that's right, or could there have been 100 models and I just picked one of those 100? And, how do you get a sense of where you are with that, especially if you're thinking about changing the structure to try and actually,
Yeah. Well, that's a really good question. It's one that comes up a lot. Thanks for asking it. I think the usual answer to that question is that our view is that this process, this generative process, establishes that a particular micro-level setup and specification of agents is sufficient to generate the observed outcome. It does not mean it's unique or even that it's the most plausible. But anything that fails at some level to generate the observed pattern is not a candidate and can be ruled out. And in practice, you rarely come up with more than one that works. But if you did come up with more than one, then you'd have some additional work to do to adjudicate between them, hopefully empirically. And I think ideally models of this sort and data go hand in hand in an iterative way. The model can help focus your data collection on the things that matter the most, as our previous speaker, I think, very eloquently spoke to, and then the data can help adjudicate between different formulations of the model. And I think part of the reason I show this Anastasi model is that model was designed with a specific purpose in mind, which was to adjudicate in a debate that was raging in the anthropological community between two factions, one of which said, it's all about the environment, and that's all we need to know, and that's the answer to why the Anastasi disappeared, and another faction that said, no, there's a lot more complexity that matters. Essentially. And so this model was specifically designed with only environmental rules and variables in mind to see just how good a job that alone could do. And the answer is what I showed you. It does a pretty good job, but there's also really important qualitative features of the real record that it misses, and that means we have more work to do to capture what's going on. I think Einstein has a great quote where he says, models should be as simple as possible, but no simpler. And that's always our goal, and we like to start simple and build up piece at a time.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Levant Manje, Virginia Commonwealth University. My background is structural equation modeling. So we do have the data, we have the model.
Right.
If the model is inconsistent with the data, we discard the model. If it is consistent, it gives us the opportunity to interpret the model parameters.
Right.
So in a sense, these are confirmatory models. Do you consider agent-based models as exploratory models?
I consider them explanatory, yes, in that sense. But I would argue, I certainly think that there's a lot to be said where possible with confronting models with data and interacting them with data. But I also really think that modeling can be useful in situations where there either isn't data or there's great uncertainty in the data, because I think theory plays a really important role in all the sciences and the history of science. I could give you countless examples of phenomena that were discovered in theory long before they were ever looked for empirically, and an over-reliance on just the data we already have in hand can lead you away from profitable lines of inquiry. So I think it's really important to think about modeling as part of the process of focusing data collection, identifying what data we really need to have. And I think it's also really important to think of it as a decision support tool that never replaces judgment, that can't do away with uncertainty, but that helps us cope with uncertainty by doing extensive sensitivity analysis and scenario planning.
Yes, just please walk to the microphone if you'd like to ask a question.
I'm Aryam Pandey from India. Mm-hmm. Since morning, we have been hearing a lot. I think if we divide, we can have in, into four parts. First part, we had state of art four studies, cohort studies, and then we had discussion on levels. Then second part. Third part, we had presentation before that, and fourth is this. Second part basically was focused on should we focus only on individual or not. So actually the idea was that individual level does not actually explain the whole thing. There is residual leftover, so there is need to look for other levels or other sectors or whatever you call and have the whole thing explained completely. Third part we saw that the strength of qualitative research, because that's using qualitative research, basically we build model, and that's ultimately what we need. Whatever studies we do, whatever we do, it has to be communicated to policy and programs. They don't understand all these technical things. And the model that he showed using qualitative and group discussions, mm-hmm. they will basically will be very helpful for a program manager or qualitative. And fourth one, what we saw was the agent-based. Now here, I think most important thing is your assumptions. If your assumptions are not good, I mean, the strength of your model would depend on how good your assumptions are.
Not necessarily.
No. But, so if your assumptions are not actually very realistic, and right. then I mean, whatever
then,
you end
then they'll
up
fail
with,
to produce the real-world outcome that we observe.
So that's what you say. And you say abstracts are nothing but models are nothing but abstracts of realistic situation.
But modeling can help you uncover those situations where the assumptions are unrealistic without knowing that a priori.
Right. So my question is that how do you get into the what those assumptions are, your inputs? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do you ensure, because every model requires inputs. You are saying bottoms-up approach.
That's
now, how do you ensure that the inputs are as realistic as possible?
Well, we draw from the best available theory and data at the level that we're working. And then we also rigorously compare the outputs of these models with the relevant macro level patterns that we observe in the real world to test whether we're doing a good job of growing the observed history or not. And if we're not, then there's something wrong with the model specification, right? So it works both ways. I think you certainly want to incorporate the best available information you have in your design of the individuals and their actions. But there's inevitably going to be a lot of uncertainty about some pieces of that. And that uncertainty can be addressed in part by extensive testing of the outcomes of these models against real outcomes.
A quick question. What kind of software are you using for this kind of
good question.
Endeavor? This is not SimCity or other.
No. Although it's used in a lot of Hollywood movies these days. But the software is primarily written in Java for these. They are fairly complex computer programs. There exist some packages now that are freely downloadable. There's one I highly recommend for people who are just getting interested in this that's called NetLogo that's run by Northwestern University. I'll give you the website if you're interested that you can download, and they have a library of already implemented models that you can play with, interact with over the web. So there are some packages that can help you build these models so you don't always have to start from scratch. But unfortunately, it still requires a fair amount of programming to build one of these.
Probably have time for one more question. If you could just walk to the microphone, we would like to ask a question.
Whoever walks to the microphone first.
You're it.
It sounds like the model that you got from this mm-hmm. exercise may not be unique. I think that's the question that Levant has raised. And I think it has some policy implication. For example, you have two models. The same model A focuses on, say, energy intake.
Right.
Food intake, and then the other one focuses on energy expenditure.
Uh-huh.
They may produce pretty much the same obesity outcome uh-huh. in terms of the graph that you have shown. Now, if you try to communicate that to policymakers, what would be their reaction? I think if you go to the policymaker with, say, results from a clinical trial,
right.
that's easy to for them to accept, and hopefully be able to make policy changes. But if you come to them with a finding and say, well, this model may not be unique, and you can either intervene
but that's true of any model, right? Even a statistical one.
Well, That's why
and,
we need.
And it's all about how fine-grained your comparison data set
right,
is.
Right.
And you know, I disagree that if you had perfect outcome data, you could generate it in two very different ways equally well, with just focusing on energy in and energy out. I think there would be pieces of it you would miss with one of those approaches that would suggest a gap that would have to be filled. But I think it, you know, you can never rule out that there are other ways to explain the same data. But what you can do is you can start a list of possible ways that you can then explore and adjudicate between empirically. And this is actually one of the advantages of team science and of the networks, modeling networks, that use many different approaches and many different models to address the same question. The one that did the smallpox work is an NIH-funded group called MIDAS, and there's now an obesity one that's just getting started also.
Maybe my question was more of a general question, you know, which relates to how are we going to communicate a system approach to policymakers. I mean, this is, I guess, if you can bring clinical trials which focuses on outcome and things that you can manipulate and tell them, you know, there is a causal effect, a possible causal effect, it's much easier for them to take action.
Not necessarily, because here we can test very cheaply and quickly many different kinds of policies and interventions. To do a clinical trial on each of them would be prohibitive and take a long time. This is much faster for a policymaker, A. And B, clinical trial requires you to already have an idea in mind that you're going to test empirically. It's an empirical approach, not a theoretical approach. And you know, things like radio waves were discovered in theory in mathematical models long before there was any empirical evidence whatsoever for them, and only after they had done the models theorized they should exist and how one might go about measuring them were they able to go out and confirm their existence empirically. And if there were no theoretical models, there might be no radio waves and thus no cell phones. It would be a very different world.
That was so productive, right? Thank you. Laurette has advised me that I'm being far too difficult about time, so I don't want to stifle discussion. If there are more questions, please raise your hand. Yeah, please. Oh, sorry, I apologize. You're next. I'll save a spot for you.
Is there a way you can use the information or assumptions from systemic dynamic simulation modeling into agent-based modeling? Or a kind of a hybrid is built on that and you can come up with that? Because there you are getting those loops and mechanisms and feedbacks and then helping agent-based modeling to be done.
Yeah, I think there's certainly a lot of scope for there to be profitable partnerships between agent-based models and system dynamics models. They address sort of a different level of scope most naturally. They address a different kind of question most naturally, and I think they're very complementary and, in fact, have worked with system dynamics people before. I would caution about trying to actually construct a single model that's a hybrid between the two. Many people have attempted it. I haven't seen one that really works smoothly. There's a lot of technical reasons why that's a challenge, but it's certainly something to bear in mind.
Okay, I have 3 points to make. First of all, let's imagine an unrealistic situation where we sampled everybody, no attrition, we have full information on everybody on every question item. So in that case, we have full information. So in that simplified situation, if you do this agent-based modeling, I see no use because we have already full set of information that you cannot create any more information without sampling further.
No, I disagree. If you have full information on everybody, that doesn't tell you at all how they'll respond and react in the face of a new untried policy that will change the dynamics. And unless you know
one sample,
unless you know all their possible state transition responses.
Okay,
right?
That's the first point.
So,
and the second point is more realistically, there is a missing data. There is attrition, there is addition, and it's going to make a lot of empty hole in your spreadsheet. In that sense, agent-based computational modeling may have some role in filling in those gaps, the empty holes, the missing data. But
that's not usually the way I think of it.
Yeah, statistical literature, there is a multiple imputation of filling in those missing data using the information already existing in the sample. So that's the second And the third possibility is when the sample is too small, the variability estimate tends to be imprecise.
In statistics, right. Not in theoretical modeling.
Right. So with a small sample, yes, of course. Yeah. So in that case, what we use is we use something like a bootstrap to create a more realistic estimate of variability of an outcome of interest like BMI. Mm-hmm. Well, I just listed three things, but I don't see where your agent-based computation modeling fit in.
It's a totally different approach. It doesn't fit in any of the places you just
identified. Would you enlighten me?
Yes, sure. It fits in I think, at least three important ways that I tried to elucidate in my talk, one of which is that it provides a laboratory for experimentation with interventions and policy in a way that's both cheap and fast and accessible to policymakers, which is not true of any other approach that I'm aware of, besides these systems modeling approaches. Secondly, it provides a way to gain insight into mechanisms that are at work where there's great uncertainty about parameters and about individual behavior and motivation. And third, it provides a way to combine across multiple levels of inquiry and many different, where there's the data is scattered and comes from many different disciplines in a cohesive framework that can provide insight into dynamics across time and at every level along the way. And I don't think statistics necessarily gives you any of those tools in quite the same way. And I think statistics is extremely valuable at what it does, and theoretical modeling is extremely valuable at what it does. And I think it's important to recognize that a model like this can work even when there's no data, and it can suggest and include variables and even suggest kinds of new data that don't exist yet. And statistics is limited by what data exists. Someone else chose what data to collect. It may not be the optimal data that we'd really like to have, and this kind of model can help suggest what that data might be.
There exists one model. The first example that you simulated, that's called two-level cross-classified model in education literature.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So there exist some models that create using this
I'm just going to have to cut this one off, I think. But I do think this is a very interesting discussion, because what it's raising here, I think, is this issue of perspective and, you know, where you're coming from and how you see these different modeling approaches. And I think they really are different paradigms, and I think they are quite complementary. So hopefully as we kind of continue through the other talks, we'll have some time for discussion and more reflection on this. But I think we're really opening up a very interesting line of discussion here. Thank you very much, Ross.
Thank you.